Welcome back to In Search of Tarot, a podcast that examines, questions, and reimagines our approach to life and the cards.
Through guest interviews and in-depth discussions, we'll explore and expand the beautiful complexities of spirituality, philosophy, magic, and more.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Angie.
And we're your hosts for this fascinating ride.
Thanks for being here with us.
Hi, Angie.
Hi, Nick.
It's good to be back with you.
It's so good to be back. It's always good to be chatting with you.
Yes,
I know you do that every episode, but I genuinely just look forward so much to these conversations.
I know. And we've been busy bees lately. So it's been like few and far between when we've been able to connect. So I've been really looking forward to this. Yeah. So welcome back, everybody who's listening. And as I sort of shared last episode, which was a couple of weeks ago now, I think, Angie and I have both had our lives like really accelerate and just a lot of different projects and commitments. And so the podcast has been slowing in its release cadence, which is, to be completely honest, gonna continue. And we're in a moment of change with the podcast. I am for sure. And trying to sort of figure out where we're gonna go from here. But for now, we're glad that you're with us. And I'm excited to keep diving into this book. I also, for anyone that's been reading Radical Tarot, there's still the option of joining us for our hangouts on Patreon. We'll have one coming up this next Wednesday, the 29th, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Eastern. And then in December, I believe, I haven't officially like locked this in, but Charlie themselves said that they might be able to join us for the final December hangout. So more to come on that. But, you know, I hope that everybody is enjoying reading this book as much as we are. And I did just want to sort of say that it's not lost on me to be reading a book called Radical Tarot in the midst of everything that's happening in Israel and Gaza right now. And, you know, I don't want to go into this into any kind of great detail for personal reasons, but I have been keeping my conversations about that private by choice. Out of respect for my husband and friends of ours, and just not wanting to post something inconsiderate or misinformed. To be honest, I feel very close to tears as I say this, because it is very, very personal, and it's also very heated, and there are a lot of very strong opinions, rightly so, out there amidst the community that is In Search of Tarot and the people that I'm connected with via the internet through In Search of Tarot. And I respect all of those opinions, and I respect the way that everyone is choosing to respond to this in whatever way is right for them. And that's all I can do for myself too, you know? So I'm saying all of this just because, you know, as Angie and I always do in our discussions, we always, you know, don't shy away from current events or tying things into the politics of the world, which I think is very important in tarot and completely believe, and Charlie believes through this text. And so I wanted to kind of explain why today you may hear a little bit more from Angie on those things than you do from me. And, you know, if that's hard for you or you disagree with that, then that is okay too, you know, but all I can do is do what feels best and right for me right now. And that's all I can do. So
thank you for being vulnerable. I feel like the heat of the moment compels people to either speak or not speak. And I understand why someone might choose to do either one, but I also want to reiterate what you were saying, Nick, of our goal on the podcast is always to uplift the voices of the marginalized. Our goal is always to center queerness and queer ways of thinking and queer ways of living, and liberation at the end of the day is always our goal. Yeah, for me personally, I'll say that I understand that I am not one of the most knowledgeable on this topic. And I also, I understand that my voice is not the one that I want to amplify the most in this moment too. So I will speak with care on the topics as much as possible.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. All right. So let's dive in. So last week we went all the way through to the Hermit. And so we're picking up today with the Wheel of Fortune, which is really a kind of a very fitting card to begin with, you know, based on what we were just talking about. This is a card that I really came into a fuller picture with when I read Sylvia Federici's Caliban and the Witch, and listened to the Book on Fire podcast, which if anyone has wanted to read Caliban and the Witch, but maybe has shied away from it because it is kind of like a dense, like more academic text, I really, really recommend the Book on Fire podcast, because they go chapter by chapter, like really hashing through the complex things that she's talking about in the text. And it's really, really fantastic. And something I learned when I listened to that and read the book along with it was Sylvia Federici writes in the first chapter of the book, which is All the World Needs a Jolt. She talks about this phrase, now is the time, which appeared in the letters of John Ball. And also she talks about this, the picture of the Wheel of Fortune, or the image of the Wheel of Fortune, was starting to appear in the close of the 14th century on like walls of taverns and workshops to symbolize this imminence of change that was coming. And it was very much tied to the Black Plague, and the way that caused like a swapping of power from the rich elite who were controlling like the serfs, and suddenly there was like a surplus of sort of the underlings, and they were starting to like rise up against that, and that's kind of what led to the capitalism, like the formation of capitalism, basically, is what she writes about in the book. So it's really, yeah, really fascinating. But I love the idea that the Wheel of Fortune is this like symbol that's just like randomly popping up, and the close of the 14th century would have been just before, you know, that Italian tarot was about to start showing up on the scene, which would have happened, you know, happened in the early to mid 15th century. Mm-hmm. And so I just think that's really interesting, and just adds like a whole, you know, another layer to the Wheel of Fortune. And I also looked up on Decameron Web, which is a project of the Italian Studies Department at Brown University, that the Wheel of Fortune took on many styles throughout the Middle Ages. And I'm going to read this quote from Decameron Web. It says, quote, "The figure rising on the left is usually labeled Renabo," which I'm sure I'm pronouncing incorrectly, which means "I shall reign." "The one at the top is marked Regno," "I reign," and is often crowned. And the descending on the right is Renavi, which is "I have reigned." And then there's a writhing figure at the lowest point that is Sum sine regno, "I have no kingdom." So it's this like power, this wheel of like, you know, rising to power, being in power, falling from power, and then having no power, which feels super like political and tied to capitalism and all of that, you know.
Feels like that's my everyday.
Yeah.
I like, yeah, waking up and then being like, wow, all of the potential that this day has. And then by the end of the day, I'm like, what was that?
Right, right. Yeah, that's so true.
That's so funny. In Charlie's book, they say, what's the old Yiddish proverb? Humans plan and God laughs. And if that doesn't just sum it up.
Yeah. Yeah. This also reminds me of, there's something I came across once about being an artist, where like when you're starting an artistic project, there's initially this feeling of like, can I do this? And then there's like, I'm doing it. And then there's like, this is amazing, like, because you're just starting, you know, you're just starting to feel really good about it, and then you're like, is this amazing? And then by the end you're like, this is terrible, you know, and like the cycle of that.
I'm talentless. Yeah, it's, yeah, that it's not funny haha, but funny in like the cosmic laugh kind of way, where you're like, wow, okay, so the universal experience is that all of us go through this process individually, but also like collectively, clearly, and we're in a moment of quite a bit of revolt and overturning in the moment too. So it's interesting to watch whenever it plays out. But, you know, even on like the macro or micro level, I should say, it's like even observing it within myself, which is why we see it in the tarot, right? Mm-hmm. But as Charlie says in the book, only asses depend on fortune's whims, or maybe misfortune is what makes us human. But yeah, I love the idea of it appearing like on the walls of taverns. That just feels very like speakeasies. You know, you kind of see, or you enter in with like a password or like a handshake. Handshake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love the idea of even of the Wheel of Fortune becoming like a modern day symbol for revolution. And actually the word revolution, even like the revolving of the wheel, you know, is kind of interesting. I also appreciated on page 93 where Charlie writes, if we freeze the wheel of time, or if we freeze the wheel in time, it appears to have an up and a down, but if we let it roll, we find that there is no permanent up or permanent down. Of course, just loving like a non-binary, like, you know, view of the Wheel of Fortune. And yeah, it's like even with an object like a wheel, which is always turning and always turnable, our minds are still trained to go into that binary direction to be like, well, this is up, this is down, you know, but like the wheel, I think, really invites like a true circular experience where like they're up and down are contextual, you know, based on where you are, like in relation to the wheel.
Yeah. There's a great portion of the book where it's on page 95, like Charlie's talking about how, where is it? The middle, it's a quote from Akomolafe. Thank you. Everything begins in the middle. The middle isn't the space between things. It is a world that in its ongoing practices of worlding itself, which is like this kind of, I don't know, it just feels very like liquid and very slippery, which I love the idea of that. It reminded me, and I wrote this here in the margins, it's kind of this like detachment that I think that the Wheel of Fortune invites us into, which is that like, you know, if you're going to rely on everything staying constant, then you're kind of fooling yourself, you know, like the constant is that things will always be moving, and the world, the Wheel of Fortune is going to be like, you know, you're pretty high. And then other times you're feeling like a little bit trampled by this wheel. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's like in yoga, there's a concept of non-attachment, which kind of allows you to, experience things without so much like ego placed on it, right? Like none of these failures are personal. None of the, you know, a lot of the things are impersonal, so that you can kind of, I mean, and I say this knowing that like, you know, as a concept, like as a philosophical concept, this works really great on paper, gives a lot of people ease as they're fluctuating through their life. But the practice of it is another thing, right? Like the application of practicing non-attachment when things are going awry is a lot more of like the actual work. But yeah, that's kind of the threads that I was, that were being pulled on for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I have something to say about that idea at a later card that I'll save it for, but yes, yes. And like, and also, I mean, I feel kind of cliche at this point quoting Octavia Butler, but that idea of change of God being changed, like, really has really stuck with me since I read Parable of the Sower. And I just think that's so true. And I think it's like really, I think the longer you like sit with that idea that like God is changed, like the more deeply it rings true and is just like really prophetic and just really amazing. And, you know, because change is like such a constant thing, you know, so there it's like paradoxical, because if change is constant, then is it still change? You know what I mean? Like if it's always happening, like it's not, then it's not different, you know, like, so it's a very interesting paradoxical queer kind of concept, you know, but lately I've just been really, I don't know. I feel like lately I've been really trying to like reconnect with like, you know, I've gone through several years now of like deconstruction and like having a lot of different ideas like open up to me. And now I'm like, okay, so like, what does this mean for like, what feels true to me now, or, you know, or like any sense of like, divinity or God or spirit, or like what, like, where am I at with all that, you know, because it just kind of all blew open, and change, which is always evolving and always moving, like framing change as God feels really useful to me, because it allows for that paradoxical nature of like, you'll never get to the root, you know, the radical root, like, And also, like, there is a rootedness to that, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting because it's like in the midst of all this fluidity, in the midst of all that change, you're kind of like looking for concrete pieces or things. I mean, maybe concrete is the wrong word, but it's like, even the notion of like truth is always moving, because what was true to me 10 years ago is not true to me now, or perhaps it's more true, you know, like that's even moving. So I find it really fascinating, but yeah, prophetic is a good word too for that, that quote from Octavia Butler. I feel that way a lot when I read her work.
Me too. Yeah.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll say about this Wheel of Fortune chapter was, actually, and I had underlined that Bio Kamalafe quote as well. And then right above it, I had underlined the Rebecca Solnit quote. Charlie quotes Rebecca Solnit saying, "An ability to recognize a situation in which you are traveling and have not arrived, in which you have caused both to celebrate and fight, in which the world is always being made and is never finished." Mm-hmm. And this kind of goes back to something I was writing and thinking a lot about at the top of the year in relation to the margin in terms of like nomadic living and nomads. And I forget the name of the book now, but I read this book about nomads. I think the book is called Nomads. I'll look it up and put it in the show notes, but it was saying how the way that we think about nomads is not having a home is not really correct, that nomads have like a moving home, you know, like that's part of the way that home kind of is, you know, and obviously sometimes people are displaced and that's, you know, different, but like I was talking about very early nomadic living, and also the way that the journey, like always being moving, always not being stationary, that was useful to me in terms of like thinking about the margin. And I think I was talking about this with Charlie when we had them on the podcast, like, you know, just not having concreteness, like we're saying, like always being moving, always being on that journey, and how kind of uncomfortable or inconvenient that can be, but also how like fruitful and always bringing something new that is as you know?
Right. It's very like, it gives that energy of like, it's more about the laughs we had along the way.
Right. Yeah.
No, for real. But I think that like I love the notion of creating home within oneself or creating home within one's community. I think I may have actually said this story before on the podcast, but there's this I think it's a Zen Buddhism parable, but they talk about like, if you ever think you've made it, then you're back at the beginning, which feels very like the Wheel of Fortune. The phrase is like, if you ever meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a kind of a way, I mean, and you can interpret this in many, many ways. A lot of people use it to illustrate like God complexes, like kill your gods every once in a while, or kill the idea of your reality, etc. But like, I love the idea of it always being this like cyclical thing, always being, or having that reminder on the road that like, when I think I've arrived, if I think I've finished, then perhaps I've come right back to the beginning. Right. I'm once again back in the space of the fool.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is like such a tender thing, I think. I'm not going to, as I say this, like, it's not, I have no answer in the spirit of what we're talking about. Like, it's just kind of naming this, like in the midst of a time when there are a lot of need for change and a lot of need, people feel a lot of need to like dig in. And there is a lot of power and need in that. How do you like marry that with that idea of like, when you've arrived, like kill your gods, you know, like, you know, that's a very paradoxical, again, thing to hold together, you know? And like, I say that because I've come across that, people have said that to me, like in comments on Instagram or things about, that it can feel spiritually bypassing to kind of say like, there is no ultimate truth or to kind of hold that there are many different viewpoints. There are many worlds within this one world. Things like that can feel like a way to just not take a side or to like not, you know, dig in.
Yeah.
But it's so like, I mean, I can definitely see how that can be the case, but if you're really doing it, like if you're not just spiritually bypassing with that, but you're like really digging into that like lack of ultimate truth, to me, that is like so uncomfortable. So not, that does not feel spiritually bypassing. That feels like leaning into like a really difficult thing to like grapple with, you know?
And I want to like underscore this always, you know, like when I was learning a lot about like processing energy, difficult energies through the body, there's this moment where often you're like breathless, right? Where you're like, and you gasp and there's a suspension. And in like, again, I'm sorry to be referencing yoga so much, but this in yoga, we call the breath pran, which is like synonymous with life force. And so it's kind of this cessation of like, or this pause that you feel, this like suspension of your humanity, what it means to be human, and all that is encompassed within that, right? And it's, I think it's so profound to just allow yourself to be sinking into that breath or breathlessness, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? To be like in awe of all of that meaning. And so I think that for those who perhaps feel compelled or pressured to say something, it's also, I think it's okay to just be grappling with humanity. It's enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And what a way to honor the complexity of that humanity with that. I think there's space for that.
Yeah. Yesterday I was listening to, I think it was On Being. I think it was an episode of On Being. I can't remember exactly what podcast, but they were talking about, I guess there's a documented experience that a lot of astronauts have when they come back from seeing Earth from like outside of Earth, where they just are like, what are we doing? Like borders are not real. I guess they don't, a lot of times they won't let them serve in the military anymore because they don't have the ability to like believe in fighting. Like, cause they're just like, this is all just made up. Like there are no borders. It's all just one place, like one world. Cause they've really seen it from outside. And I was like, wow, that's so incredible. You know,
it's funny that you say that because it, right when, you know, this all came to a head in the news, I was like looking through pictures of, there are the really beautiful pictures of Jupiter, and there are pictures of the moon, like Jupiter's moons. And it's contrasted by like the swirling clouds of storm that are happening. And I remember being like, whoa, and it's a second to just zoom out and both kind of sit with like the insignificance of myself as a little tiny blip in this universe, and to like really honor the humanity again. Like I was just saying, like to put aside my pettiness and my squabbles to center what's really important. And I think that, yeah, I don't know if I'm making sense here, but I think that it's important to zoom out. It's important to honor when we find ourselves in those kind of like, whoa, you know, moments.
Yeah. Yeah. A second ago, I wanted to tell you, like, I really appreciate that you and I sit in the space of awe. I feel like in these conversations, cause we're like, we're trying to like see all sides. We're trying to like hold space for everyone that's listening and ourselves. And it's just like, you know, I feel like we're communing with like the margin or whatever you want to call it. Like, you know, where we're, you just are like speechless. Like you're saying, you're like gasping or you're like breathless. Cause you're just like, there's too many ways to see this, and we'll never see it all. And isn't that frustrating and incredible and awe-inspiring, you know?
It seems to be like the timing of us talking about these really difficult cards, as we're observing so much societal like stuff happening. Mm-hmm. It really is interesting. And I feel like every single chapter of this book that we're about to talk about more felt so relevant in that way. But I really do appreciate, I think that there's something about like that awe that really, I don't know, there's something so like divine about humanity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, shall we move into justice?
Yes, let's do. Yes, okay. Yes.
So justice chapter, the one note that I made that I wanted to just draw focus to is on page 101. You know, as a dancer myself, and you're a dancer, like I could not help but love this quote at the top of 101 where Charlie writes, "A tarot student of mine who was also a dancer once said to me, that balance is not a static state, but a series of constant small muscle adjustments, which, end quote, which I will say, yes, that's correct. Like when you're balancing, like in ballet, you're always like kind of moving. And that's something that actually I often have to really teach to my younger students, because, you know, you see, you hear the word balance and young kids will think that they're supposed to just stay totally still, you know, yeah. and like, just kind of almost like hold your breath. Like you're saying, like, almost like just freeze. But yeah. balance is not freezing. Balance really is like squeezing this muscle and then this muscle and like moving over here, you know, like, and it really takes a lot of moving to stay sure. balanced. Yeah, you know?
Like a series of micro adjustments that have to happen in your foot in order to stay still. In fact, like, I feel like we're talking about space, but the equinox only happens twice a year for like just a moment, right? Like
right.
It's, balance is fleeting. It's easy to wax poetic and think that like, that's, you know, we are always striving for that. But in reality, it's like, we're constantly micro adjusting and reprioritizing to find that. And so,
yeah. And even like, I mean, it's the same with like in the spiritual space. I mean, something that I've come across a lot lately is like, the way that wellness and spiritual space can kind of make you feel like something's wrong with you if you're feeling like an extreme emotion, you know, like, that you should kind of be neutral. And my full-time job, like, which is non-tarot, we've been talking a lot. I'm part of an LGBTQ working group, and we've been talking a lot about like the word safe space and how a lot of people don't really love that term, and prefer like welcoming space or something like that, because I don't think we can really claim, or like safe to who, you know, like according to what, you know, but also like, there can be this feeling, I think, when we say safe space, where we have to like maintain this neutrality, you know, like where it's not, we don't feel like we can get messy or angry or sad or, you know, like, so it's not really like, I don't know. I don't always find that term safe to be the most useful. But I also think like in this kind of conversation where it's like, okay, we need to let people have more extreme emotions. And then we like pendulum back to like, okay, now we need to like come into a neutral place. You know, it's like it's like really what we're looking for is a constant adjusting. And like any sense, like we just said earlier, of like killing your gods, like any sense of like, this is the way is like not the way, you know?
Well, then we've missed the point, haven't we?
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like and to your point, it's like safe for who says, and we kind of, you know, bounce back and forth between this idea. We said this a lot with the Hierophant, I think, last episode. But I mean, I wrote down on page 99, it was like creating this kind of, you know, being a heart-led thing, like justice being this heart-led thing, instead of this, like, what was it? Not by a floating God mind, but by a beating heart, which is what Charlie says in this, on this page, which made me think of like manifest destiny, you know, like if we think that, this justice is like a concrete thing, you know, then it starts to create these imbalances, which, you know, if we're talking about neutrality, then there would be no like difference in power dynamic, period, you know, mm-hmm. not to begin with. So it would be that, you know, that's where we kind of start to see those power imbalances shift anyway. But
yeah. I wanted to pull out this James Baldwin quote too, that they use from 1962, which is, morality, if it is to remain or become morality, must be perpetually examined, cracked, changed, made new.
Another prophet. Mm-hmm.
Another prophet. Yeah. I don't know. That's really, I think there's a lot to sit with there of, when the concept of justice gets, gets like too fixed or too concretized, and how that does only make it riper for cracking, which like the queer cracks I'm all about. And like, it just keeps unfolding. I don't know. I feel like the idea that, I'm very interested and feel very compelled by, again, this idea that God is change, and like, and included in that is the constant cracking and to be made new again. I mean, it's in the world outside. Like right now I'm looking outside my window and all the trees the leaves are fallen, the trees are barren, and then they'll come back and then it'll happen again. It's like in the world, you know, like, so I don't know that we'll ever, I don't know that there is another thing that could happen other than that. I mean, that is the world, you know?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And nature will always move to balance itself, as we're seeing, like, you know, on a climate level, like that's what it's trying to do, is to rebalance itself for what we have created and, you know, are trying our best to shift. At least we, you know, who are the folks on the bottom, I should say. I hate to say it like that, but that's kind of how it feels.
Anything else justice related?
No, I think we can move on.
All right. Why don't you kick this chapter off to the hanged one? What stood out to you?
So I really loved the hanged one. I think the hanged one, historically has felt just kind of like, you know, I always think about, like, well, my hands are tied, and it almost feels like it does feel in some ways like whenever I've pulled the hanged one for people, it just feels like they have been put in this situation by someone else and their hands are tied, you know? And so they must do, you know, nothing except for, like, they feel kind of a victim card has been drawn for them. Mm. But I really loved this take by Charlie, because I think it puts on a different spin. Like I think that there were so many things that I wrote down here. Let's see, right here where it was on page 104, where upside down, the hanged one is, it's said to be the upside down position of St. Peter, who has to be crucified upside down to humble himself for denying Jesus. But then they later in the chapter liken it to when Odin hung himself upside down, from the tree, from Animus, I think it's the world tree, excuse me, mm-hmm. To gain wisdom. And I thought that was so interesting, because, like, I never really noticed that the hanged one seems to be kind of almost like grinning. It's almost like they have a secret or something like that, that they're withholding from everybody else who's observing them. Like, they've been put in this situation, but it's almost like they have something that nobody else knows, which kind of gives them, I don't know, there's something about, like, laughing at something in order to shrink it, mm-hmm. That I think is kind of like the thing that gives the hanged one a little bit of power, like a little bit of the upper hand, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I love that, because I feel like what the hanged one was, what that punishment was meant to be, was to shame the hanged one. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of something that Charlie points to too, was like the effort or the role of shame in creating change is to kind of shrink a person down, to make them believe that they are the problem, and then to kind of, like, silence them. But then mm-hmm. in that way, like, the humor of the hanged one, or being able to, like, hang upside down, or to change your perspective is to shift the shame into something else, which is, you know, and I've been thinking about this a lot in the last month or so, which is, like, when we're moved to try to create change, I think sometimes we often feel ashamed of what we say or don't say. And so that's what kind of is our motivator to speak or not, mm-hmm. you know, because we are ashamed or we're afraid of being shamed. But I think that the role of, like, guilt, I always say, is like a guiding emotion. It prompts us to, like, learn more or to do something, and that guilt can be a really good thing. And anyway, I love this kind of spin on the hanged one, because it let's see, what is it? I put some brackets around it. What does it mean for the hanged one? In a radical and liberatory tarot, we must unlearn shame. We must become shameless, and which means becoming unafraid of difference, you know, unafraid. And perhaps that's what the hanged one is smiling at, is perhaps that they're thriving in this kind of, like, being spotlighted. I don't know. It amuses me to think about, like, what it is that they might be grinning about. But mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about what it is to be part of a a group of, because Charlie goes on to say in that same paragraph, when we become unafraid of difference, we become unafraid of defying group norms when the norms are harmful, unafraid of disrupting the status quo when the status quo is oppressive. In other words, we become unafraid of being a traitor to the systems of oppression and injustice that run on shame and run the world. I have not been part of any kind of like, radical group or, activist group in any kind of like formal sense. But it must be a difficult thing to, because disruption is obviously super important. And I think people that are like radical activists are like always looking to disrupt, which I think is fantastic. But it must be hard too, because I would think that there would be some element of trust that might be hard. And I'm not trying to say that like trust should be not speaking up or allowing people to do things that aren't right. Like, that's not what I'm trying to say. But we all do make mistakes all the time, like all the time. And to be surrounded by people that are constantly kind of calling out your mistake, even if it is justified, must be a really hard like state of living to be in all the time. Does that make sense?
Like a vigilance that you're wearing all the time.
All the time, right.
I think part of this, and I think that like part of it is being okay with being wrong. Like, in fact, I was part of one of those groups very recently where an individual made a pretty out of pocket comment. And a lot of people were, hey, that was actually like kind of a messed up thing to say, like, let's invite you back into this conversation. What were you actually trying to say? Or what's at the root of this, like, hostility, because we're all here because we're bleeding hearts, like, we're all here because we care. So what is this about? And ultimately the person ended up leaving the group because they just didn't want to be participating. And I think that it was hard for them to be spotlighted in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was part of it, was that all of us felt a lot of like, we felt like very tightly wound in that moment. And I think that in order to soften, which I'm reading this book called Liberated to the Bone. And very often in the book, she'll say, pause, when she's talking about like a difficult thing, for instance, she's talking about like, the displacement of Native people from their land. And she'll often say, okay, take a second, let's breathe, let's ground ourselves in the moment. Where is your body? Where is your mind? And all those things. And I so appreciate that, because it lets me, it reminds me rather, that I have built up all of this kind of like, oh my God, yeah, she's right. Like, my nervous system is so dysregulated, and I didn't even think about that, because my vigilance was already kind of coming up. And before I knew it, it was all the way up to my throat, and I didn't even realize it.
Yeah. Something you were saying earlier was reminding me of the biblical quote. I forget which chapter it is in the Bible, but when they talk about Mary, when Mary is, I think, first conceiving Jesus, maybe. And it says like, Mary pondered all these things in her heart, that what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And I'm saying this because I, as I said before, I really like to look at the majors, in the numerical, like, groupings.
Yes.
And so the hanged one is 12 would also go with Empress. And if Empress is kind of like creation or like gestation,
yeah.
and then also along with those cards would go the world, which is kind of like the finish line, or the, like, in the midst of that is pregnancy, basically, and how uncomfortable it is to, like, not that I know, but from what I hear, like, how uncomfortable it is to carry a baby, how strange it is, how, just everything shifts, and all the sort of pooping and peeing and all the things that we don't really even talk about with that, like all the things.
Yeah.
And that's something I think is important to kind of hold with the hanged one, is just the discomfort, that can come with it,
Yes. Yeah. In some way, the nature of being suspended, I guess, is gestational in its own way too, because you're kind of like, in a moment, and I think maybe I've said this on the podcast before, I can't remember, but Sylvia Plath writes in The Bell Jar in a really great way of saying it, she says that the character or the protagonist is saying like she feels like she's in the middle of an eye of a tornado. And that's kind of how a lot of things feel when you're kind of in this space of like you're watching all these things kind of spinning around you and you're trying to orient yourself. Yeah, I think it's super important to be like uncomfy in that space, acknowledge the uncomfiness, and then, you know, sometimes be able to play in that, like in that uncomfiness, be able to laugh at it, give yourself like a brevity of like, okay, I'm allowed to be here in this space. Yes, they are calling me in and this is incredibly uncomfortable, but they're not doing this because they think I'm a piece of shit and I need to be miserable. They're doing it because they believe in my potential. And so anyway, yeah.
Yeah. And none of us are gods. I mean, I love that you pointed out that the hanged one almost looks like they're smiling. I mean, that's a perfect reminder of laughter. I love that you like pulled laughter into the midst of all that, you know, because yeah, it's just human foibles, you know. Okay, let's go to death. Speaking of, are we in death?
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Uh-huh.
Okay. So, what are some death thoughts that stood out to you?
Okay, so I love this card for a lot of reasons. I think it's always the one that stereotypically everyone, it's like this one, the devil and the tower that everyone's like, oh,
yeah,
no.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes it does. I think that especially, and I think it's really important, you know, with, like I said a second ago, you know, it's easy to romanticize these as philosophical concepts. And I don't ever want to bypass the fact that these things are incredibly difficult, you know, and the way that I move through those is with a heavy dose of humor, a lot of mourning, a lot of anger. And I think that all of those things have a place. And I think that by bypassing it, you know, on a body level, when we bypass those things, we start to alienate ourselves from each other, from ourselves, and from ultimately the planet, which I think is the source of a lot of our problems. But, and so to what I'm trying to say with a death card is like, you know, we can, and I think Charlie points to this later in the chapter, they talk about the like butterfly allegory of like, oh, the goo phase. Yes. How romantic the goo phase. Mm-hmm. When everything deconstructs and yes, I'm in a goo phase. I think that's been co-opted by a lot of like, you know, the wellness industry and the girl bosses and all of that, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm a big fan of Caitlin Doughty's work. I don't know if you follow Caitlin Doughty. They are, she's a mortician. And I first found her on YouTube years ago. She's fantastic. For anybody who is kind of a nerd around like death and death things, Caitlin Doughty writes several books and she runs a channel called Ask a Mortician. And we'll put this in the show notes so that you can refer to this later. I highly encourage you to go and look at her work. Her work is just so moving. She takes a lot of this kind of humor and uses it to examine death and dying and the culture of death that is kind of around death and dying, the way that we sanitize it, the way that we like pump it full of chemicals and kind of create this like, oh yes, it's still human. Look, it still looks like your aunt that died, but it's like, she really doesn't look like herself. She's embalmed. She looks like weird and puffy and her makeup looks too pink, you know, like whatever. The thing I'm trying to say here is it's really easy to romanticize death, but the truth is that death is death does not judge. Death comes for us all. Death is ugly. And there is a process of unbecoming that we find ourselves in these death moments, right? When we're talking about like the ending of a phase, for example, or talking about like the literal death of a person, whether it's ourselves or a family member or any of those things, like, I don't know. I think that there's something to be at death's door and to be able to be with death and all of the emotions that accompany it are so moving and allow us to be a little closer to that moment of rupture, you know, to be really with that raw moment, I think is one of the most holy things that we can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like I quote this all the time, but Sophie Strand talks about death being the moment when the cup like overflows actually, rather than being the end of, you know, the dryness of the cup. And she tells this story about coming across a dead deer on a walk one day and then returning to that carcass day after day and watching how it fed all these creatures and then, you know, became mushrooms and fungi and, you know, and how it just like actually like life flourished from that death. And I just think that's so beautiful and like so powerful, and not, again, not that is romanticization of it, but it's also a truth that like death and decay do create more life, you know, and that, and there's still space within that to hold the grief and the difficulty and the pain and the scariness of actually dying, the act of dying. And exactly. also there is a flourishing that occurs, you know, as well. I was just going to say, and to relate death to another major, it would be the emperor as 4 and death as 13. And like, if we look at the emperor as being a structuring or like a building, then what is a better teacher for that than a dying, you know, like a decaying and a disintegration. And like you said, an acknowledgement that this too shall pass, that we all will die, you know, and Charlie mentions the Danse Macabre in this chapter, which was like a Black Plague medieval kind of humorous depiction of the way that death was the great leveler, that death came for the king and the peasant and everybody, you know?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I don't know. I have a lot of thoughts on death and dying, but like, I think that there's something really special about being able to like get really close to those things. And maybe that's what's part of what's so scary, is that the death and the dying is really what connects us to each other, right? Like every one of those people that is dying across the sea is someone's baby, you know, in the same way that I look at my baby and I love nothing more than her or him, you know, those people are someone's baby too. And so those deaths are, I am connected to those people in that way. I am no different. So anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel the need to kind of hold a little bit of moment for like grief, you know, in the midst of death, because that's something that like a lot of people are feeling right now. And a lot of people are not being given time to feel, you know, there's a lot of grief, you know. Well, do you feel ready to move to temperance?
Yes, we can move to temperance. I just might be a little bit sniffly, so pardon me, everyone.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah, temperance is an interesting card for me because it is like the card that always gets pointed to when we talk about queerness in tarot. Which is awesome. And to be honest, has always also annoyed me because I'm like, this is like the one card that a lot of people will talk about queerness with, you know, like, so I love it and it annoys me. And I think part of why it annoys me, which I've never thought about this before, but I think temperance is probably the last card. And in a lot of ways, even now, like I feel the least connected to, because it is so nebulous, which now I'm understanding like is the point of it, like that really is kind of the feel of temperance. So maybe that's helpful for anyone out there that might be listening and might be feeling like, gosh, I really don't connect to this card. It's like, well, exactly, like that's kind of the point. Like it's kind of this like in between, like Charlie actually calls this chapter temperance the healing in between. And gives it things like synthesis, fluidity, combination. And it was interesting to me to learn that A.E. Waite himself writes about the angel that's depicted in the Rider-Waite-Smith deck, saying, "I speak of him in the masculine sense, but the figure is neither male nor female." So it's interesting that A.E. Waite was even pulling that out, which, you know, I don't always love A.E. Waite, but like that's interesting to me, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting because I feel like when I was learning the tarot, and pardon me, everybody, I'm so like in my feelings, so I'm definitely sounding away right now. But I think that when I was learning the tarot, it always kind of was like the middle way, whatever, you know, there's just kind of like a moderation card, which I always was really frustrated by because I was just like, okay, it's kind of like, you know, what it reminds me of is when people are like, oh, hey, what kind of music do you like? And you go, oh, everything. Like I listen to everything. And it just kind of sounds like you listen to nothing, like mm-hmm, you don't mm-hmm. have the vision. And so that's kind of how I felt about temperance historically, but I feel like this being the kind of playground where all possibilities exist, right? Like Charlie says, like it's like a synthesizing or a confluence instead of separation and division feels better to me. Like it starts to make more sense, right?
Yeah, I like this. I like this quote on page 118. Charlie writes, "There are more problems in the world than temperance can remedy, but temperance's call to mixing, combination, and fluidity is a place to start. Temperance asks us to look for the sites of connection and confluence instead of separation and division, offering opportunities for dialogue, understanding, and mediation. They remind us, to paraphrase Audre Lorde, that our differences can be used as bridges instead of barriers." And I do think, like, in moments of tension and difficulty, like we're experiencing right now, like, you know, of course, just like any other time, like we're going to go towards the tools that we're used to, you know, or like the things that we've been raised with, which is not normally non-binary thinking, which is not normally like confluence and all those words that Charlie just used, you know, which normally is division and kind of, you know, digging in and things like that. So it's an interesting card to like, kind of use as a guide in this moment, you know?
Yeah. I think that like, you know, it's on page 119 where Charlie says that their DBT therapist, talks about how the emotional mind and the rational mind meet and overlap to become wisdom, which I think is so, I think maybe that's like a great way of looking at it, because I think that this is a good card for people who are insisting that the spiritual doesn't really intersect with real life stuff, which I think is so, to me, that just feels like completely antithetical, but that I think that temperance invites us into the space where you're like, okay, but why can't they exist in the same space? Like, why can't these things make my reality more spiritual or vice versa, right? Like, why can't these things that I don't think have anything to do with each other, why can't they intersect over here? You know, it is very truly revolutionary in that way. It can be very radical in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'd forgotten that Charlie actually does quote Sophie, since I brought Sophie up a second ago on page 119. Sophie says, "The opposite of patriarchy is not matriarchy. The opposite of a human is not an animal or a rock or a blade of grass. The opposite of our current predicament, climate collapse, social unrest, extinction, mass migrations, solastalgia, genocide, is in fact the disintegration of opposites altogether."
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Our friend the devil.
Our friend the devil. Ooh, I loved this chapter.
You what?
Yeah. Do you want to start with this one, Nick?
Sure. Well, first of all, it's interesting because Charlie calls Caliban and the witch out in this chapter, which I already, you know, talked about earlier. Fair. Yeah. And then on page 125, I highlighted this quote where Charlie writes, "So often the supposed success of a social movement is measured according to the white and or cisgender members of its constituency, ignoring the continued oppression of its more marginalized members. For example, in the erroneous perception that gender equality has been achieved because there are mostly white and cisgender women in positions of power, while women of color and trans women are still suffering," end quote. And that's a really heavy thought and is very true, you know, like the devil, like I mean, for me, the devil, again, to relate it back to its partner, which is the lovers, you know, if the lovers is a real coming together or like synthesizing, which I think of the lovers in that way, then the devil to me is a moment of feeling separate, you know, and so kind of is interesting in relation to temperance, you know, to look at those two cards together too. But like, you know, a moment where you feel detached or you forget about the unity of yourself, or you forget about the unity of all of us, or you forget, like in this quote, which this quote is speaking to, that like none of us are free until all of us are free, you uh-huh. know, that like where it starts to piece apart. Like for me, the devil kind of brings in a false sense of delineation or separateness, uh-huh. you know?
Yeah. I think that for me, whenever I'm thinking about devil, I'm thinking about like pain points and the way that, like, for instance, in the body, right? If you have like a pain point or the core wound, and then you have like these symptoms that start to radiate out from the core wound, right? And what we're doing, you know, when we go to like a doctor or whatever, is that they're going to start to treat the symptoms. Okay, well, if you're dehydrated, let's give you this thing and we'll hydrate you back up. And sometimes that can help to kind of get to the bottom of what's actually happening. Like when I was in my religion, they would always say, oh, the devil will never be the hideous beast. He'll be the handsome stranger, because that's way more like sneaky. That's much more in the spirit of the trickster, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that I always think about the devil, and then I'm like, okay, so we have this inflammation that we're seeing, and how Charlie writes about it is like, in order to break free from the devil, in order to release from the chains that the devil has around us, we first have to know what the devil is, right? Like, we have to kind of follow that breadcrumb trail of symptoms back to what the actual core wound was and why it's inflamed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's reminding me of when I was learning astrology last year, I saw the glyph of Pluto for the first time, and Pluto, you know, is kind of related to like Hades, and kind of therefore a little bit tied in with like devil, or, you know, sort of that underworld, you know, kind of idea. And the first time I saw the glyph of Pluto, I was like, it looks like it wants a hug. You know, because it did. It like it's it looks like its arms are outstretched.
So they call it like a wounded, what is it? The wounded healer?
That's Chiron. Chiron.
Oh, my bad.
Yeah, no. Yeah, and so like, and it's making me realize now that something else I've thought for a long time about the devil is like, I kind of feel sorry for the devil, because, and that's through like Buddhism, like you were mentioning earlier, Buddhist philosophy. There's this idea of like having tea with your demons in Buddhism. And I learned that through this queer sangha I used to go to in New York. And we did this exercise where, this really extended meditation exercise where you did like ask, you kind of like externalize the problem or the pain point that you were experiencing as like an outer demon. And then you asked it like, what do you need? And the leader of the meditation was like, let yourself be surprised by the response that you get back, because it may not be like what you think psychologically is like the problem or like what you need. And I can't remember what I heard, but whatever it was not what I expected to hear. And then you go through this whole thing where you like give it what it says it needs through the, you imagine it as like a stream of like gold nectar that you're like feeding the demon, and you just let it eat and eat and eat and eat until it feels satiated, you know? And so like with the devil and demons and things, I've always thought like, instead of like trying to push that away or turn away from that, or kind of, you know, be like, I don't have that problem, or I don't have that vice, or I don't have that, you know, addiction or whatever, like you really have to turn to it and be like, you are here, you are asking for this, like, I hear you, I'm not going to just ignore you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to ask you what you want. And that to me relates kind of back to the lovers, and the way the lovers really is a learning to love the self. And then the devil is that piece that maybe is hard to love, and that mm-hmm. you kind of want to turn away from, but really you need to turn back, because that's all you have is yourself, you know, like in turning back to the self, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, and we could go into like in, you know, when dealing magically with demons, right? Like you have power over the demon if you know its name, but
oh,
you know,
yeah.
There's like the whole thing about like knowing the demon's name and having the power of the name, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that that's really cool too, because I think that if we're talking about like on an emotional level, say we're doing a lot of self-healing, then I think that the naming of something can make it feel at once more real, which makes it feel a little bit scary, right? To say, if you have like a diagnosis that you've received and you're like, oh my gosh, this makes it feel so much more real, and that's scary. Yeah. But it also gives you information. It gives you data on how now to understand yourself in a way so that this thing does not have power over you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, mm-hmm. and I love what Charlie writes about egregores, which is another like magical concept. And for anybody who doesn't know what an egregore is, it is a non-corporeal spirit that arises from the collective thoughts or beliefs of a group of people. So if we're thinking about like an egregore, they're talking about like the Lavender Scare, or New Age Love and Light is kind of its own egregore, or the Satanic Panic is its kind of own, you know, it's like this thing that we, or a concept that because enough people give it power, it becomes a thing. You know, and so anyway, I just think it's really interesting to investigate it on that level, because now we're talking about when, I mean, traditionally I learned about the devil as being like vice, you know, is synonymous with vice. And that can also be, you know, the thing, it can be vice, but I think sometimes vice is, you know, where we go to escape. And so escape from what would then be the question, I think.
The tower.
Oh yeah. We're getting into all the, like, I mean, this is the meat and potatoes of the tarot, you know?
It really is. I was thinking about that, like you said earlier, I was like, wow, it's really a lot, but also appropriate to be talking about these cards right now. Yeah. So I guess I'll just keep going down my whole thing with like relating it to other cards. I literally just wrote an article earlier this year for the Rebus about the Chariot and relating it to the tower. And just the splitting or the falling or the cracking, you know, all these words that we've been using throughout this conversation, and the queer cracks, you know, and like, if the Chariot is kind of a construction of self, then the tower is the deconstruction, you know, or not even self, but just if we have construction, then we have deconstruction, you know, and like the power and difficulty and usefulness of deconstruction. In that article I wrote, to a queer person traveling the incessant highway of the overculture, the idea of things falling apart might sound like salvation, end quote. And I mean, I think that that concept and that idea is like really powerful in the world right now. I think that a lot of people are feeling that, and we feel like very close to like a true tower moment in a lot of ways, which is incredibly necessary, like incredibly needed, and incredibly scary. I mean, like, you know, just like an overwhelming, you know, like even in the midst of how needed it is, it's still scary to be like, you know, what happens next, you know?
And the fallout, you know?
Yeah, the fall, right.
The fallout that we're experiencing is devastating. And so I think that it's, you know, I think like we were talking about with the death card, like, I think it's really important to honor, and we give these things meaning so that we can extract, you know, we're trying to pull meaning from them so that we can make these things significant, or we can grow from them, et cetera, et cetera. But some things don't happen for a reason, you know, like, and they don't have to have a reason. Sometimes they just happen and it's terrible, you know?
Yeah. That's, I wanted to read the end paragraph of this chapter. Charlie writes, "And for the towers that didn't need to fall, for the calamities that happened for no good reason, I'll leave you with this. Sometimes things don't happen for a reason. Instead, things happen and we give them a reason as a way to soothe our grief. We make the reason, create the meaning. And then sometimes, as we continue living and breathing, hoping and trying, as we continue creating the future, we make it true," end quote. And I mean, that's, I think, what we do with tarot. Really, yeah. You know, we make meaning, and that's, I mean, it's true that everything doesn't have a meaning, or everything doesn't have a reason, and we make it. But like, I think that's a relationship, you know. It's like, it's not that nothing has meaning, and it's not that we make everything up. It's like somewhere in between that, you know, where like we co-create meaning along with everything else, you know, that's happening in the world. And rereading this chapter made me think of Carlo Rovelli, who is an incredible physicist, author, and in the book, The Order of Time, Carlo Rovelli writes, quote, "The world is not a collection of things, it is a collection of events. The difference between things and events is that things persist in time and events have a limited duration. A stone is a prototypical thing. We can ask ourselves, where will it be tomorrow?" End quote. And I think that's really humbling and feels kind of helpful to think about things as being less concrete and more about like events. You know, it's like, now this is happening and now this is happening and now this is happening, you know, rather than it feeling quite as fixed, you know, to kind of go back to that change theme.
Yeah. I think I told you about the like breaking of the shelf thing, that the metaphor that we as Mormons and ex-Mormons use. But I feel like this, that the tower is kind of the breaking of our shelf, you know? And like, I think I told you this last time, but that I never want to be responsible for the breaking of someone's shelf, because it is so awful. It is so painful. But, and I say that with even how like, how wonderful I feel on the other side of that.
Yeah.
Even how I know that there will be positive change on the other side. It doesn't take away from how, you know, it feels like the rug has been pulled out from under you, you know?
Yeah. Well, to me, that's the star. Are you ready to move into the star?
Let's go. Yeah.
So to me, what you just spoke about, like, is that relationship. Like, I always tell people whenever the star comes up in a reading, like, you know, this is the Maya Angelou, like when it starts to rain, say thank you, because a rainbow's coming, you know, like it's that the star is like, knowing that on the other side of this dark night of the soul is going to be, something greater, and you're going to be a better, stronger person for it. And also it sucks, you know, like it doesn't take away from the fact that like, it is hard as hell and it sucks to go through the tower. But on the other side of it, you are really changed, you know, and I feel with the star, like a sense of destiny, or like a sense of being pulled because of that, because you do know, like in those moments, like, I know that I'm going to get through this. I know this isn't going to last forever. And it's fucking hard, you know?
Yeah, it is absolutely. It's just like a glimmer, you know what I mean? It's after all the things, have kind of happened, and you've come out, you know, very, very recently out of this like destruction, I suppose, then that you're kind of just like panting, right? Like I'm seeing myself at the end of a race and being like, holy shit.
Yeah.
But it's kind of this like, oh, that, you know, that's it's whatever tethers you to what's next. And even though you don't know what that thing looks like, it's just the tiniest little glimmer of what could be.
Yeah, that's such a good metaphor. Like, it's like when you wake up to go to the gym and you're like, you really don't want to go, but you know you'll feel better after you go. You know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. The moment before you pass out after your heaviest set, you're like, oh.
Yeah. Or I used to feel that way. God, when I was a ballet dancer, there were some pieces we did where like, it was so daunting the moment before the music started, because you knew how tired you were going to be at the end of it, you know, but like, but also you knew that you were going to feel good at the end. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I also, you know, I love Jose Esteban Munoz and quote him all the time. So I love that Charlie on page 139 quotes Munoz, who says, the here and now is a prison house. We must strive in the face of the here and now's totalizing rendering of reality to think and feel a then and there, end quote. I mean, like, yes. And as I read that, I'm thinking about, again, another podcast with a person who was talking about, having a child with disability, and the way that I didn't know this, but as they were sharing it, it made sense that until the turn of the century, prior to the turn of the century and eugenics, there had been a feeling of an ideal. Like it's a very Greek idea too, that like there's this kind of ideal beauty and ideal symmetry and things like that. And there was an acknowledgement that one could never be that, like that, but that's kind of what you were striving towards, but no one would ever actually reach that, you know, whereas the eugenics movement made ideal made like majority neutral, like that the way most people are is like normal, end quote, you know, and that outside of that is abnormal, you know, and therefore normal became ideal, which is like not a thing, you know.
That's so weird. I think about, you know, that John Steinbeck quote where he says, and now that, where is it? I actually wrote it for a different chapter. And now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good.
Yes.
You know? Like when we let go of this ideal of perfection, you know, then we can kind of settle into that, like, we are enough. All of us are enough, you know?
Yes. Yes. And that also reminds me of, I forget who said this. I love this quote, that it's never too late to be who you always wanted to be. or something like, I think I'm butchering the quote, but it's something like that. This idea that you can always start again, you know, that it's never too late. I feel that feels very Star to me, you know, like, and also very much like what Munoz, I think, is saying of like, the here and the feeling that like what is now is like what will always be is so overwhelmingly on us and yet historically inaccurate. Like, we know that the way things are is not how they're always going to be, but it's hard to like overcome that feeling, you know.
Yeah, I think the Star is such a beautiful card, but, and I think it's a kind of an underrated card, if I'm being honest. I feel like a lot of focus is drawn to the other cards, but anyway, hope is such a tender thing too. Like, I think, and Charlie says this in the book, they say hope carries the reality. Oh, pardon me. Hope too can be and will be disappointed. Indeed, it must be so as a matter of honor, or else it would not be hope, which I think is so true. You know, hope exists because of the potential for like disappointment. Anyway,
what are your moon thoughts?
My moon thoughts. I love moon card. I feel, you know, that's, I'm a Cancer, and that's the ruled by the moon. And so I feel like I just weigh, you know, I'm swimming in the soup is,
yeah,
my constant state. I think it's so funny. Whenever Charlie references the moon, they say the moon has no gender. It's a rock. But
I know, I love that.
Every single time. It's like so funny to me, but yeah, it's like being able to really kind of, because we always see in the moon, there's like the two, either there are two towers there, or there's like a here and a there, or there are pillars, or there are walls, or whatever. And I just think that like the thing that we can do in the moon is just to like be free to move around in the complexity. Wallowing in complexity is like a thing that you learn in college English, I think, which is to kind of just like not really land on a final place, right? I love it.
I think the moon, I always think of the moon like really drawing that out of us too. For me, I always think of wildness with the moon. Like, I guess I think of kind of the full moon energy of that, like howling at the moon and maybe letting your inhibitions go and like being out in the woods and in the moonlit night, you know, and how the moon like illuminates those like dark places. But going along with what I too love that quote and like underlined it three times about the moon being a rock. Charlie also quotes Sophie Strand, or no, they don't quote Sophie, but it made me think of an old essay of Sophie's where Sophie says, the moon is always both the crone and the maiden, the day king and the night queen, the non-binary bowl where everything mixes, just like the ocean that mixed Aphrodite's foam into form. Both shadow and glow play across the changeable face of a being that loves to live outside definition. The moon is mostly both, always trans, waxing and waning. The moon only ever flirts with fullness or emptiness for a brief, tenuous moment before slipping into change.
Oh God, I love that.
Yeah. I love thinking of the moon as, because it's true, like the moon is the most frequently changing and shifting like planet, you know. It only stays in signs for like, I think two to three days or something.
Yeah, that's so wild. It's so interesting that you bring up that point of it like drawing that out of us. Like I remember this, I'm going to tell this story. Please don't do this, anybody listening at home. When I was a teen and I was learning how to drive, and I was absolutely so restless whenever there was a full moon, I could not sleep. I was like tired, but wired, you know, I could not sleep. So what I would do is go through the mountains at night, and we have this long, you know, kind of winding road through the canyon. And during the winter time when all was snowed over, but the roads were clear, I would go through the canyon during the full moon and turn my headlights off. I know. Oh. Don't do this at home, please. I don't know how I didn't die, but like, but it was so beautiful to me, the way that the moon illuminated the snow and everything looked glowing and purple and so surreal to me. You know, it almost looked like a Lisa Frank painting where it was like, everything's purple.
Yes.
And it was just so beautiful. Like, I just loved the idea of the animals being out during this time and doing their wild things and me being among them, you know?
Yeah, that's so perfect. That's such a perfect image for like the moon and the weirdness that a lot of people talk about the moon is like being about dreams and illusions and things. So that's like that's a perfect visual for that.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway.
All right, the sun. So both of us kind of share this feeling like, and I think a lot of people, I've heard so many people over the years be like, I hate the sun. I can't, I don't like the sun card. You know, like it's just so interesting. Like I
I
think, yeah, like I think for me, like I do think that the sun can feel very exposing. The sort of like acrid, or I don't know if that's the right word, but like aridness, I guess, is a better word of the sun, where it just, I always picture just like, I don't know, I'm someone that hates being hot. I don't really like summer. I prefer winter. So the sun sometimes can just feel like oppressive in a way, you know?
Erica, my friend Erica is the same way. She just detests being hot. I, on the other hand, I just, and the reason why I'll say for me that the reason that the sun doesn't feel as like exciting to me is that it doesn't seem that complicated to me. You know, I love being hot. I love being, if I could sleep in like a 100-degree dry room every night, I know your eyes are going. That I sleep like a baby in that I just thrive there, and I love the aridness of it. And I think that there's something about that, like kind of uncomplicated, like I'm just here and I'm just going to not be apologetic about it. And it is scalding to some, you know, like I thrive, and I know that I'm one of the weirdos who loves to be in that space. But I think that as like a tarot card, that's maybe why it doesn't feel as exciting to me, is because it's just, you know, they're unapologetic, and it's just kind of shining and bright, and you know, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's making me think of how it can be really hard for people to accept joy. Or there's as soon as you have happiness, you feel a little bit like nervous about losing it. You know, like I think maybe that can come up sometimes with this card, like or like kind of what's it called when you like self-sabotage, you know, like where you're kind of subconsciously afraid of getting the thing, you know, that you want or whatever. And it also makes me think of I've written about this before on Instagram. I have a very weird thing where I get so clammy about showing moments where I'm like overly happy. Like if I like for the first time we ever went to like a wand shop in Boston, I remember walking in and just being like, you know, like this clamming up and like really inside, like and my friends were like, aren't you like Jason was like, aren't you so happy? Like, do you like this? Are you happy? And I was like, yes, I'm incredibly happy. But like I didn't want to, it's like I don't want to show it.
Because you know what? It's like, I think that maybe one thing that we can say, because I wrote underneath, Charlie puts the alternative names are joy, illumination, and bliss. And I put confidence underneath that. And I think that there's something like I think about this all the time with social media, for example, where I'm like, why did I let myself be seen so much? Like I could have just been mysterious and imperceivable, but I just decided to be so cringe. And I'm, you know, I'm kind of like in the space of like, you have to be a little bit cringe to get anywhere. But I do wrestle with that, where I'm like, oh God, that kind of confidence is so overbearing and annoying. In fact, I have like this video. I have this video when it from years ago when I was in Vegas. I was there for like a contortion intensive. And I met up with a friend on the strip, and we were just walking by the Bellagio. They played Cher, who anybody who knows me knows that I'm an absolute diehard for Cher. But they were playing Believe, which is, you know, like I know that song top to bottom. It was dancing, and my friend took a video of me, and in the back you can see these two girls that are like absolutely, they just look so crabby at me. Like, I don't know what I was doing. I must have just been ruining their day or something. But the way that they're looking at me in this picture is so funny. And I think that's maybe part of the difficulty when we're allowing ourselves to be seen, is we invite that kind of like, you know, you may get people that really reject or project rather their insecurity onto you. They hate that you're being so visible. And that's part of the crux of like being seen in your joy, is that it will be judged, and that's really hard.
Well, speaking of judgment,
There we go. We're segueing so nicely in from chapter to chapter.
Right? This one, I think, is as someone that grew up in like repressive Christian, you know, teachings, this one, it took a long time to like deconstruct from that for me. Like, it's just so, it's so tied into the imagery and like Judgment Day, you know, and all of that. And again, like, to be honest, I think along with Temperance, it was probably one of the last cards that I felt like I really connected to. Mm-hmm. And for me personally, like, I can't remember how this happened. Actually, I do. It was through the Apparition Tarot. If anyone owns Apparition Tarot, I love that deck. It's like very, very contemporary art, kind of minimalist, but really beautiful deck. And something about that deck for me one day when I was sitting with Judgment really connected me to like ancestry, and particularly like queer ancestry, but just the idea that like at the finish line, like if we're looking at the major arcana as a linear journey, which we don't have to, but you know, we could, like if we're kind of looking at it in that way, that like towards the finish line, there would be this like deep connecting to like your place in the overall journey and line of like life itself, you know, like, and connecting to like ancestors and those who have gone before and been judged before, you know, or like how they might help you find your place in the line in general, you know, like, so that's kind of, that has nothing to do with what Charlie wrote necessarily, but it's like how I have personally connected to Judgment over the years.
Would you say that, do you perceive Judgment as being towards the end?
Well, in that framing, yes. Yeah. I don't think it has to be, but in that's a way that one could look at it, you know?
No, it's interesting because, and I'd be interested to know how, and anybody listening to this would perceives it as well. In the way that I learned it is that Judgment feels like more of a checkpoint or a red flag, which is to say that you shouldn't check out necessarily, but it is like an assessment moment. Mm. And so
And I think what's important to say about it being towards the end is that there are many endings and beginnings throughout life. You know what I mean? So it's not necessarily like the end, but it's like, it's like a end point, you know, like a, cause if the world kind of falls back into the Fool and it all starts over again, then like Judgment is like towards the end of that one particular cycle that you're on. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, and if we place Judgment periodically through like the Wheel of Fortune, if we're just kind of like planting it there inside of the wheel, then it would show up in many different spots, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So interesting. I think that, Judgment is such a harsh one. And especially if you did grow up with that kind of religious framing, it's hard to depart from that. But yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess the other thing, you know, that this is a moment of judgment in a lot of ways that are necessary, a lot of necessary judgments and a lot of harsh judgments and a lot of it being easy to judge, or, you know what I mean? Like thoughts like that kind of come into my mind right now in the world with this kind of idea of judgment and what it is to literally be judged and be judged by others, or feel that shame or that guilt, like you were saying, which can be a very powerful, like wake up call, you know, like sometimes you do need to kind of listen to that. Like, I feel guilty. I feel shamed, you know, like, what is that about? But also, you know, don't cast the first stone lest, you know, don't judge lest ye be judged or whatever, you know, like that kind of concept, you know, as well, I think comes up with this card.
Yeah, I mean, Charlie says later towards the end of the chapter, they say surfing on the tension, which I think is very indicative of the moment that we're in right now, is that there is so much tension and we're all just trying to navigate the feelings that we feel of wanting to be as present as possible with the catastrophes that we're seeing unfold in front of us. And, you know, how weird to be like experiencing these mundane things also at the same time, like I'm doing
right.
My laundry and seeing this absolutely catastrophic news, you know, unfold in front of me, and then having to be like, oh wait, I have to pick up my son from play practice now. Like, it's so weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. I agree. And I, there's something to that, I think, like to really figure out, like, you know, moving forward, because this is the first time that a war like this has been this publicized, you know, in this way, like with social media, and it's very useful. Like it's very powerful. It is a tool for sure, like an important tool. And also, what does it mean to be like sitting in the hair salon and open Instagram and see, like the other day, it was like the first thing I saw was all these dead bodies, all these dead bodies laying on the ground. How do I properly take that in? Like, what does that mean? Like, what should I do if I'm in the midst of like joking around with my friends and open my Instagram and see that? Like, if I just close it and move on, it feels like I'm setting up my system to just do that, you know, to like kind of desensitize from that, you know? So like, and also I can't always just like stop everything I'm doing and like properly hold space for that, you know? So I feel like we're going to have to figure out how we want to use that tool in like the most thoughtful way possible, you know, like, cause that just doesn't feel right. And it does feel desensitizing, you know?
Yeah. It's very jarring to our nervous, like our nervous system is not built for this. And I think that, I've seen a lot of conversations about how we are, and maybe that's, you know, another judgment moment of like, this tool that we have is so important. How do we implement it in a way that helps us and doesn't, you know, like stop us in our tracks, because that doesn't help either.
Right. Right.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So,
all right, we've arrived at the, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I said coming full circle.
Yes, we've arrived at the world.
Yes.
Which can also be a little bit of a strange card, I think. I think when I come to the world card, for me, it does feel like graduation is a word that I think of with this card. And like, for me, it's like really taking in, it's like a moment to like take in all that you have done, you know, because it's like, what was it all for if you don't ever take a second to be like, wow, like I did that, you know, or like something that you've accomplished, like I, you know, otherwise, like, what are you working for? And also, as soon as I see the world, I think about the fool, you know, like I think about what's going to be next, or, you know, and how do you like hold space for like what is right now and not just be always thinking about the next thing, but also know that like this is fleeting and a next thing will come. And, you know, kind of that like middle place of that is like what I think of with the world.
Yeah. I think the world is such a, like, it's kind of like gratification, but not so like obvious as that. It's almost like a contentment card, I would say. Like, we're just going to take a moment to just take in and absorb and feel the completion of this thing, you know, before kind of stepping into like this next, what's next, grind culture, hustle thing, you know? I think it's such a lovely card, but it is fleeting, like what you were saying, you know?
And something that's hard for me at work, is the complicated kind of paradox of like, it's never going to be perfect, or like what even is perfection in terms of like, you know, if you're doing like, if you're talking about like inclusivity, maybe, you know, like there's only so much that we can do at our workplace without actually like toppling the whole system as a whole, you know? And also we shouldn't let that stop us from doing like something,
yes,
you know, but I really struggle with that because I am in numerology, I'm an 11, like I am a really giant big picture thinker. And for me, like, it can be really hard for me to let enough be enough for now, you know, like, because I just feel like, well, that's not really solving it. That's not really getting the heart of it. So like, why are we even wasting our time with that? And people are like, well, we have to do something, you know, and Charlie writes about that on page 164. They say, in a living world, insisting on a utopia of perfection is not only unlikely, but it can also prevent us from enacting better, though imperfect, potentialities. And that's a really good lesson for me to just like sit with and try to live through, because that can be really hard for me.
I think it's interesting. You kind of like, it made me think of being in any kind of activism space, there's always this kind of sentiment of like, you know, when we have this thing that we've accomplished and we can have this moment of like, yes, it's, you know, something that we're doing is actually working and we're making positive movement. And there's always this voice in the back of the head that says, but it's just the beginning, or there's just, this is just a little bit and we're always still moving. And so how to witness those successes without undermining it by saying like, well, it's never enough.
Yeah.
You know, I think that also contributes to the fatigue and the burnout that we feel, or perhaps the cynicism. You know, I think that cynicism, I would say that cynicism is like, you know, the disappointed optimist's way of like kind of diminishing their hope, because it hurts to hope. It hurts to have your hope disappointed. And so, you know, how do we hold all of these things and, you know, continue?
Yeah.
Anything I think else? That there's like an interesting, and I would love to, I know that this might not land in a way, like it might feel controversial to some. And I only open this up for conversation because I have felt conflicted about it in the past. And I feel like I kind of waffle between one and the other. So what I'm getting to is the quote by Solnit on page 164 is the idea that if you embody what you aspire to, then you have already succeeded. You know, there, this is in kind of creating the world that comes next is in part, right? Like if we're going to use the idea of like being the change that we wish to see, then that means that we're living the future now, you know? And I love the idea. I love that idea. Right. And so this is an idea that I've ping-ponged back and forth with, which in my head, whenever I'm doing something that I'm hoping creates social change, in my head, I'm always repeating the mantra, like, we are free. We are already free. And what the energy, the vibration of that actually feels like, and the energy, trying to live the energy of liberation now, helps me to kind of walk differently through the world. And so when I think about that, and when I say this, like I understand and I believe in this phrase, but the phrase is like, you know, the none of us are free until we all are free. None of us are free if one of us is chained. That sentiment is so true. And I really absolutely believe in that. I think it's so important. It compels us to remember that our liberation is interdependent and interlinked, you know. But sometimes I wonder if the energy of that still keeps us like imprisoned. You know what I mean? Like the energy of like, none of us are free until we all are free keeps us here sometimes. And that's the point, right? Like I said, to remember our togetherness. But you know, what do you think about that when I say that?
Yeah. Well, I just want to thank you really for bringing that up. I don't have any answers or really even a response except just to say, I understand what you're saying. I haven't thought about that framing before, but I definitely understand, you know, that Ari Felix, who was on the podcast early this past year, teaches dream world building. And there is a lot of tension. And interestingly, Ari talks a lot about the utility of tension, like the points of tension that arise from dream world building as being really important, powerful places to like notice and kind of rest into, like
I waffle between the two of them because I feel like I believe one more depending on where I am, you know. And I do believe in the energy of vibration. Like I think that's why, you know, going to a rally and everyone shouting that, you know, if words are spells and the vibration of like we are free is ringing through the air, I think that is very, very moving and compelling, and the energy of that is felt. You know, I think that's why it's so important that we continue to show up in that way, because it reminds us of our relationality to each other. And then I'm like, yeah, but what are we saying if we're words are spells, you know? Anyway, and I know that I even feel differently about that sentiment. Anyway, I don't really have an answer to that. Like I said, it's always kind of moving for me the way that I feel about those things. And so I would love to hear from the listeners if they feel one way or the other on that.
Yeah, no, I would too. Yeah. And I didn't come up with any questions ahead of time, but I think, you know, in the spirit of wanting to leave people with some like takeaways and also some things to discuss either with us, you know, via email at isoppod@gmail.com or on Instagram or at our book club hang. I just would love to hear how this particular collection of cards is maybe resonating with people right now. You know, I mean, this does feel like a really timely grouping of cards, like in the midst of everything that's going on in the world. And so I would love to hear about that. I really would love to just like hold space for any sharing or any processing that anyone needs to do around everything, because it's a lot. And these cards are like portals for like all those really, really intense, deep places, you know?
Tender, yes. Yeah. Thank you, yeah. Nick, for letting me ramble at you. Thanks.
Same. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about this. I just really am so grateful for you. And I'm so grateful for this conversation. I think both of us, prior to hitting record, felt a little bit of weight and hesitance and like unsureness and fatigue and maybe not even wanting to open the can of worms or not feeling able to, you know, like in the midst of everything. But I have really enjoyed this conversation, and it's reminded me that conversation and connection with people is so important and so healing. And so I really thank you for being in this dialogue with me today.
Thank you, Nick. I really appreciate that. And I appreciate you too.
In Search of Tarot is independently written, recorded, edited, and transcribed by Nick Kepley and Angie Miller. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl_, that's BIRDGERHL_. And you can follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot. Have a question or a comment? Email us at isotpod@gmail.com. We also invite you to leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.